With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, a declaration that allows Fresno County tomato producers to use critical material. We'll have more on that. But our top story today, sugar producers have an issue with USDA's latest nutrition standards for school meals. Rusty Halvorsen has more.
School lunches may begin to look a little different next year. USDA announced updated nutrition standards for school meals that will be gradually updated to include less sugar and greater flexibility with menu planning between the fall of 2025 and the fall of 2027. From the sugar industry's perspective, Harrison Weber, executive director of the Red River Valley Sugar Beet Growers Association, says there are some good takeaways from USDA's latest guidelines and some flaws, too.
Yeah, you bet, Rusty. We kind of got the good, the bad, and the ugly from this. You know, the good news is they dropped the limits on grain-based desserts. Flavored milk is now going to be allowed for all grades. And then also maintaining the weekly 10% limit for added sugars with the July 1st, 2027 implementation. So that's kind of the good. The bad, if you will, they did keep added sugar limits for certain categories, which included yogurt, cereal, and flavored milk. And really then, Rusty, the ugly is the rule did not restrict low or no calorie sweeteners, which included the artificial sweeteners. And so we argued that if you're going to be transparent and want to be transparent and you feel you want to regulate sweeteners, then doggone it, we gotta be watching those artificial guys as well.
Weber says the sugar industry just wants a level playing field.
Well, I think that holds true on all of these labeling restrictions and guidelines and regulations. You know, front of package labeling is becoming a big issue for us. I think consumers do want to know what's in their food, and that's great. And we are 100% behind transparency. And that's all we ask is that, hey, if we're going to put how many grams of sugar in there, then or that it's not in there or whatever, then also let's say what it's being replaced with, whether it's aspartame or some other artificial sweetener.
That's Harrison Weber, executive director of the Red River Valley Sugar Beet Growers Association. I'm Rusty Halvorsen.
You may not have heard about corn stunt disease, but it's been dropping corn yields in Argentina this year by as much as 10 to 15%. CJ Miller reports whether the disease could also be found this year here in the U.S.
Corn stunt disease is a disease that is caused by a spiroplasma that is actually transmitted by leafhoppers in the field.
And that's Dr. Darcy Talenko, Associate Professor of Plants Pathology at Purdue University.
Generally here in the United States, we have detected the disease, but it's been a minor issue. It's mainly been found in the southern part of the United States, in southern Florida and Texas. And I know you're talking about they're having major issues in Argentina, but here in the United States, it's been around for a while. So that have reports that they found it in California in 1996, and they continue to find it. But generally, we don't think it's leading to significant losses here in the United States.
So far, she says, two things are absent that would lead to the spread of corn stunt disease here in the U.S. this growing season.
The inoculum has to be present for the leafhopper to pick it up, and then you have to have populations of the leafhopper with the disease that would spread it through the crop canopy.
Overall, Dr. Talenko says she's not worried about corn stunt disease having a major impact on corn yields here in the U.S.
Generally, we don't see many viral diseases here in the United States causing losses to corn. So I would say not really a disease problem I'm worried about seeing. I would keep an eye out, I guess, if I start hearing more reports out of Texas or Florida, where they might start seeing a little bit more infection since it's already been documented there and they've seen in California. So again, we'll monitor that and we'll keep an ear out with our counterparts that are in those states if they start seeing a problem with it. So I'm hoping it's not a disease that we're going to have to worry about.
According to Reuters, the Rosario Grains Exchange in Argentina has slashed its corn forecast by 6.5 million tons to 50.5 million tons last week due to the recent impact of the insect and the disease. I'm CJ Miller.
There is potential for another large U.S. soybean crop in 2024. Chad Smith has more.
The USDA released its 2024 Prospective Plantings Report in March. Mac Marshall, Vice President of Market Intelligence for the United Soybean Board, talks about the soybean numbers that stood out in the report.
Well, headline number for soy there, 86 0.51 million expected acres, just based off of the surveys that took place in February and early March. Really right in line with what the trade was expecting. Average pre-release guess, I think, was 86.53 million acres. So really right on the nose, but it's still very early.
The potential is there for another large U.S. soybean crop.
This figure that we're looking at right now, basically a 3 million acre gain from last year, but still relatively low compared to what we'd see in 2021, 2022 as well. Put this together with kind of the standard rate of abandonment or harvest plant ratio with trend yields, and we'd be looking at a crop potentially on the order of 4.5 billion bushels for this year. So certainly potentially large.
Marshall says the prospective numbers don't always come close to the June report.
Certainly a lot of changes that can happen on the margins between now and when we get the acreage report at the end of June. Farmers are naturally trying to navigate markets, navigate input costs, and pencil things out as best they can, while of course managing the agronomic realities of maintaining a strong crop rotation. So lots to uncover here. This is of course just a survey. We'll get the information on what actually went in the ground at the end of June, but as of now, 86.5 million acres looking at for soy.
Keep up with the latest news from the United Soybean Board at unitedsoybean.org. Chad Smith reporting.
Chuck Zimmerman has today's National Spotlight.
At the Agri-Marketing Conference, I'm visiting with Laura Sveck, who is going to be our new president in just a few minutes as we're doing this interview. But I wanted to get just a couple words from you about your thoughts, your plans, your ideas as you become new president in your year.
I have been really blessed to work with an amazing executive team, and we've kind of put together a rolling plan. So my goal is to not come in and hurry up and try to make my mark before I leave. I want to make sure that I keep things moving and steering in the way that we have been. And my personal goal is I would like to find some of that next generation to fall in love with NAMA the way our group has. We've kind of created a tribe, and I really want to help gear that next generation to be able to keep that tribe and keep this organization as strong and stronger when I move on. Not that old, I won't be leaving, but I just won't be on the executive board anymore.
Well, judging from this conference and the numbers we have here, NAMA's done very well at what we call recovery from those last couple of years.
We have been very blessed to have a servant leader in Jenny Pickett. A lot of nonprofit organizations didn't make it through COVID and the pandemic, and under Jenny's leadership and the way she constantly kept the executive board and the officers in the loop and coming up with ideas, and I think we're in a really good place. I think that we're almost back to where we were pre-pandemic, and like I said, if we can get that next generation to fall in love, this organization has a really good opportunity for the future.
Okay, just before we close, just any other comments you want
to make? Just to thank the board that I've been able to work on. I always say I get a bonus year because we froze the board during the pandemic. Most people get 6 years, so very excited to get 7 years. And I may have to do a coup to keep it on. But NAMA has really good volunteer leadership. Everything from the board to you for doing what you do, making sure everyone's involved, and then all of our different committees. So just thank everybody for their involvement, and just to encourage them to remain excited and help us get that next generation as involved and as in love with NAMA as we are.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Laura, and congratulations. Here at the Agri-Marketing Conference, I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
That was today's National Spotlight. Now here's the livestock report. The outbreak of HPAI in the American dairy cattle has the attention of Canadian officials. Dennis Kai has more from Canada.
Canada is closely monitoring American cattle herds infected with highly pathogenic avian influenza, or HPAI, and how U.S. officials are handling the situation. Currently, Canada has received no reports of HPAI infections in its cattle or hog operations. While its name implies the virus affects only birds, other animals, including mammals, can acquire the avian influenza virus. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency says the virus currently infecting U.S. cattle is believed to be the same that's been spread by migratory birds to domestic poultry flocks. Symptoms for infected dairy cows include a sudden drop in milk production, thicker milk, a decrease in the cow's appetite, and signs of dry manure output. Dr. Martin Appelt, a veterinarian with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, says that given the situation in the U.S., the Canadian cattle and dairy industries have been put on high alert, although no HPAI has been reported from the Canadian dairy, cattle, or hog sectors at this point.
We are watching the situation in the United States very diligently, and that informs what we're doing here in Canada. Highly pathogenic avian influenza in Canada is a notifiable disease by law. So any occurrence of that disease, when it is found, has to be reported to CFIA.
Researchers and veterinarians familiar with pathogenic viruses say that while an influenza virus jumping between very different species, such as birds and mammals, is not extremely common, it is not terribly rare either. Avian influenza has been found in dogs, foxes, polar bears, and sea lions, as well as in humans. So, according to Martin Appelt, finding the bird flu virus in cattle came as no great shock.
The fact that an influenza virus infects different species is neither unexpected nor highly unusual. A virus that is predominantly infecting poultry occasionally develops the ability to cause illness in a species of mammals.
In terms of human safety, the commercial dairy industry has been fairly well prepared for an outbreak such as this for more than 150 years. Dr. Martin Appelt says the milk pasteurization process is a solid safeguard against influenza viruses.
Pasteurization has been a lifesaver over generations. Pasteurization done right has proven to be highly effective in eliminating or greatly reducing most of the pathogens commonly found in milk. That includes influenza viruses.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. With a preview of what you'll be hearing today on Agnet West, here's Farm News Director Brian German.
An emergency proclamation is allowing Fresno County tomato growers the use of a critical material. Fresno County Ag Commissioner Melissa Cragen explained why the emergency declaration was needed for combating beet leafhopper.
This declaration, it's new this year, and even though this is not a new pest, beet leafhopper has been present in California since, you know, early 1900s. However, in the last year, there has been some regulations that have placed heavy restrictions on the use of neonicotinoid pesticides in California. And unfortunately, those happen to be the only materials that are effective against controlling beet leafhopper. And so, part of the provisions of the regulatory package that went into effect early this year was that there's an exemption for use of neonicotinoids that are being used to control something under a local emergency proclamation. And so, you know, that's really what is being done here is that, this pest is specific to the western portion of the San Joaquin Valley where it overwinters and then kind of comes down into the cropland. And so our board has made the steps to proclaim a local emergency so that our farmers can use these materials to protect tomatoes in Fresno County.
AGCO Corporation and Trimble have finalized their joint venture transaction. The venture known as PTX Trimble combines Trimble's precision agriculture business with AGCO's JCA technologies to provide farmers with factory fit and retrofit applications in the mixed fleet precision ag market. AGCO holds an 85% stake in the new venture, with Trimble owning 15%, and it will be integrated into AGCO's financial statements. PTX Trimble aims to offer farmers next-gen precision ag tools across various equipment brands, enhancing AGCO's technology offering in guidance, autonomy, spraying, connectivity, data management, and sustainability. AGCO expects consolidated precision ag revenue to exceed $2 billion by 2028, aiming to accelerate innovation and benefit farmers across various equipment brands. Senators LaFonza Butler and Susan Collins have introduced legislation aimed at supporting the specialty crop industry. The Specialty Crop Security Act of 2024 seeks to bolster the Specialty Crop Block Grant Program, increasing its annual authorization from $85 to $100 million. Supporters note that the legislation empowers specialty crop farmers by allowing them greater influence over how these funds are allocated by state departments of agriculture. Endorsed by various agricultural organizations and co-sponsored by several senators, the act addresses the underfunding and oversubscription of the Specialty Crop Block Grant Program. It emphasizes the importance of funding for initiatives such as food safety research, workforce development, and water supply innovation, crucial for the competitiveness and sustainability of the specialty crop industry. The bill's proponents advocate for its inclusion in the upcoming Farm Bill reauthorization. The Bureau of Reclamation announced a slight increase in the Central Valley Project water allocations for South of Delta contractors and those in the Fryant Division. South of Delta Ag contractors will see their allocation rise to 40%, while the Fryant Division Class 1 allocation was increased to 100%, and the Class 2 allocation has increased to 5%. Despite improvements in hydrologic conditions, allocations remain conservative due to long-term uncertainty and regulatory constraints. However, Westlands Water District expressed disappointment with the 5% increase, citing favorable hydrologic conditions and reservoir levels. The district questioned the allocation's basis, suggesting it may overly prioritize fisheries concerns and lack transparency. Westlands is calling for a higher allocation to support agricultural needs and seeks clarification on decision-making processes for future water allocations. UC Davis continues to be recognized for its leadership in the fields of veterinary science and ag and forestry. According to the QS World University Rankings by Subject 2024, UC Davis has ranked second globally in veterinary science and agriculture and forestry. This marks UC Davis's consistent recognition as a leader in these fields, having held the top three position multiple times since 2015. Additionally, UC Davis was ranked 35th in life sciences and medicine and achieved top 50 rankings in environmental sciences, geophysics, biological sciences, geology, and development studies. The rankings are based on factors such as academic and employer reputation, research impact, and international research network diversity. The 2024 rankings analyzed programs in 55 subjects at nearly 5,000 institutions and ranked more than 1,500 universities across the world. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Food price inflation this year could be the smallest in several years. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
In 2022, grocery store food prices went up a lot, by about 11.5%. Last year saw prices go up by a still historically large 5%. However, food shoppers could get a break this year. The Agriculture Department's new forecast for this year is for a food price hike of only 1.2%.
That would be the lowest percent change since 2019.
USDA economist Megan Schweitzer had been forecasting a 1.6% food price hike, but during March, food prices did not go up at all.
And so that is part of what's contributing to our annual forecast being adjusted down.
That, plus low inflation rates for other things that affect food prices, things like energy. And also, of course,
prices for unprocessed agricultural commodities have just begun increasing again, but they had declined for a year and a half before that. And they're still down about 20%.
Down 20% from their peak 2 years ago. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA and the U.S. Agency for International Development are providing life-saving food aid to citizens in food insecure situations within 18 nations. Rod Bain has details.
$1 billion, with a B, dollars in emergency food assistance to nations with populations needing life-saving food aid.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Agency for International Development will deploy Commodity Credit Corporation funding to purchase U.S.-grown commodities to provide emergency food assistance to people in need throughout the world.
Shane Danielson of USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service points to recent numbers regarding chronic hunger around the world as the catalyst behind the food aid package.
An estimated 205 million people need life-saving food assistance around the world, and some 768 million people are facing chronic hunger. These U.S. commodities will go a long way to strengthening global food security through the provision of nutritious U.S. global commodities.
The joint food aid effort takes a two-pronged approach.
An initial tranche of approximately $950 million will support the purchase, shipment, and distribution of various U.S. commodities, and a separate pilot project of up to $50 million will also eventually be set up to utilize U.S. commodities that have not traditionally been part of U.S. international food assistance programming, but that are shelf-stable and suitable for use in feeding food insecure populations.
The breakdown of commodities included in the initial $950 million tranche of USDA USAID emergency food aid looks like this.
This initial tranche will support the purchase, shipment, and distribution of U.S. wheat, rice, sorghum, lentils, chickpeas, dry peas, vegetable oil, cornmeal, navy beans, pinto beans, and kidney beans.
18 nations across various parts of the globe are slated to receive this initial round of support.
A number of countries across the African continent. There are also countries included from the Caribbean, as well as the Middle East, and also into Asia.
The announcement of the emergency food aid package is a culmination of intentions announced by USDA last fall to purchase American-grown commodities and work with USAID to ensure those products would reach people around the globe in food insecure situations.
The notion was identifying populations that represent some of the most food insecure populations globally and that also complement other pre-existing programs that are administered both by USDA as well as by USAID. Our two organizations have come together to really work through the details of how to implement the strongest program possible that plays to the strength of both organizations as well as embraces U.S. agricultural community in a way that will really create meaningful effect and impact for countries in need around the world.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
It's a busy time of year for gardeners. Gary Crawford goes over some unusual gardening advice in this edition of Agriculture USA.
For those of us who love doing lawn and garden work, this is one of our favorite times of the year.
I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring, don't you?
I do, yes, and it's a good time for the nation's extension lawn and garden experts, too, but it's also that time of year when they start to come out of the woodwork, and we're not talking about termites, right? I hope you're curious now and that you do like a little oddness in your life and maybe a few laughs, because that is what we hope you're going to get on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. When you are an expert whose job it is to handle questions from the public, to try to figure out their problems and fix them, well, you may sometimes run into some questions or problems or suggestions that seem just a bit
crazy.
And a lot of times they get these crazy recommendations from their neighbors.
That does not mean that the people themselves are crazy, just that it might seem that way. This from Kansas State University Extension Lawn and Garden expert Dennis Patton. He says sometimes problems are caused by taking the neighbor's yard and garden advice.
The average person gets their lawn and garden advice. It's from their neighbor. And I jokingly tell people, you know, I've talked to your neighbor before. And trust me, you don't want to get your advice from them because I know the crazy things they've asked.
For example,
we get the home remedies from time to time.
Got milk?
You know, milk seems to be a salvation for everything for some reason. Spraying it on, I've heard that one.
Oh yes, milk as weed killer, fertilizer, insect controller should make the dairy producers very happy, except Patton says there's no truth in it. Of course, there are folks who don't use milk to kill weeds. Here's a story about a guy who is much too sophisticated for that. However,
the wife called our office and the husband went out to do weed control. Husband didn't read the label. Husband sprayed the non-selective herbicide all over the lawn. And just killed out, from her description, about three-fourths of it. You just see the trails where he took the little wand and just had this trail throughout the lawn where he killed it all out with not reading the label, didn't understand some herbicides work differently. Let me just say she was not happy with her husband.
Well, to keep this even as far as gender goes, though, this next one is a hot one, and we do mean hot.
We have an insect called fall webworm, which these webs get all over the end of the branches of the tree. So this call, I had a call from a woman, her tree wasn't leafing out this year. And we went through everything under the face of the earth trying to figure out why this tree wasn't leafing out. And then finally she goes, well, you know, last fall I had these fall webworms, so I took a torch and burned them out of the tree. Do you think that would have killed the tree? Bingo.
Tree go, too, unfortunately. You remember what Smokey Bear used to say?
Only you can prevent forest fires.
But Dennis Patton's version is...
trees and fire just don't go together.
Ah, but wait, there's more. Here's one from a 1980 interview I did with Deborah Smith, at that time an extension agent in Virginia. One day, this guy comes into her office frantic. Oh, and he says, please, please, Deborah, our hybrid poplar trees. They're dying. They're losing their leaves. You got to save them. So he goes, Deborah sends off the sample he brought in to the university for a diagnosis.
Next day, his wife came in with another branch sample, and she was very agitated as well. I've got to know the answer by the weekend. I'll tell you the reason why. We planted these hybrid poplars as a living fence around our property, very thick fence and screen from our neighbors. She said, we're having a hot tub party this weekend, and we're nudists. We need those trees as a screen. If the leaves keep falling off like this, the neighbors will start to complain.
Or maybe they won't. But anyway, they fixed it and everybody was happy. So next, we've got a brand new story from Kansas State University horticultural expert Ward Upham. He says there used to be a guy around his town who did some horticultural work.
Every once in a while, he'll do some tree planting for people. And this guy hired him, and he took him down to a neighbor that was down the street and said, I want a tree exactly like that. He said, okay. And so a week later, he had a tree that looked exactly like his neighbor's. When he drove past his neighbor's, his tree was missing.
Oh, wow. He dug it up at one place and moved it to
another. Yes. Yep.
Is this guy still running around free?
No, that was years and years ago.
Well, let's hope so anyway. That's all the time we have for today. Thank goodness. You have been half listening, at least, to Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Susan Littlefield has today's interview.
You know, sometimes something on social media catches your attention and you're drawn in and you want to follow the story as it evolves. And for many inside and outside of agriculture, it's a cow with an ear tag of number 88. Hi, I'm Susan Littlefield. We're going to head to Ulysses, Kansas and talk with Clay Scott. I actually came across him one day when I was on X, formerly known as Twitter, and I saw this cow, and she was huge and she was waddling. Well, as I followed more in some of his previous stories, I found out this cow has kind of become an internet celebrity.
You know, it's surprising and even kind of crazy how people latch on to an event or something like that. But, you know, it's kind of fun in many aspects. I mean, she's a unique animal. She's pretty strong and viable and in good health and all that, but she's incredibly large. And so I think, you know, I was making just a sarcastic comment about the eclipse when I saw her walking one day. And I think, you know, that clip's had 140,000 views or something like that since then. So I think that's kind of the novelty of it. But then, you know, I've been to meeting after meeting in agriculture for the last 10, 15 years where they said, you know, we need to do a better job of telling our story. And if using 88 to tell, you know, that we're doing a good job out here and the farmers and cattlemen are working to take care of their animals, that they'll pass along that story and tell the public and the customers, you know, that they can have confidence in what we're doing out here.
You know, Clay, I think it is such a unique and fun story to tell because not only are you getting those in agriculture closely watching to see, you know, another post from her. Nope, she's still as wide as she was. To those non-ag folks who are wanting and craving more information.
Yeah, I think that's the aspect and I'm not good at this. I'm not technically sound on any means of this. I struggle to post things and even sometimes I'll post things in the field and then not realize till 2 or 3 hours later that it didn't go through because the internet service was sketchy. So then I have to figure out how to redo that or remember what I sent last time and those kind of things. So I'm learning as well on this.
The last post you had from her was from earlier today, as you and I are talking on a Thursday. And I loved the comments. His bag is firming up some, but again, ... we wait.
Yeah, we do. You know, it's quite the ordeal in some aspects. I mean, you see her, and we've been watching her since February, thinking, oh, she's going to calve any day now, as big as she is, not really paying attention to anything else, just looking at her visually. But, you know, she's going to come out right towards the end of the window here of the calving season. It's just, I wouldn't have expected her to be the one of the very last. So it'll be a dash to the finish, but it's going to be a mile walk or something like that. It's no rush at all. And she's happy and content. I mean, for all the uncomfortable lookingness of the waddle and the pictures I put on the internet, you know, she's in a good mood most of the time, other than unless she lets me know about something.
Yeah, she seems like a very, very docile cow. Talk about what breeding she is and how you guys came about getting her.
Yeah, we started our cow herd up last year, probably about this same time, and just on a local contact, I was able to buy this herd out of the Phillipsburg area. There was a group selling a ranch up there, and they were dispersing their red Angus cow herd and good genetics and backgrounding and things like that. And so it was almost a perfect fit for us. I think both sides, we were both very glad to work through this deal. And so we got her here last year, you know, and I think in April of last year, there probably wasn't a blade of grass on the farm. And then we had 22 inches of rain last summer. And, you know, we had really good growing conditions, and her weight and kind of shows you about what the High Plains offers to feeding cattle out here. You know, we've got good dense nutrients. They get a lot of energy per mouthful, and then we had almost a perfect winter for gain. And so, you know, she was able to convert a lot of those groceries into pounds and hopefully baby calf, and you know, without having to shiver through cold and wet and muck. I mean, it was kind of a warm, dry winter for the most part, with occasional rain and snow.
You talked about doing some ultrasounding, but you were just ultrasounding to see bred, not multiples by any means.
Yeah. Our vet does that, and we weren't. You know, if he saw twins, I don't think he ever mentioned it. But you know, I think we were just looking for staging and making sure that, you know, we had a good, healthy baby calf, and that the mama was in good condition. You know, we weren't really looking for twins. So, like I said, we've had two other sets, which is that's a good number for the number of cows we've calved out there on that field.
What a great opportunity to use a cow that is waiting to calve to further educate those in and outside of agriculture about the industry. You can follow along and see how number 88 is doing. As of now, she hasn't calved yet. Follow along on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Scott Westacre or Clay Scott. I'm Susan Littlefield.
You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. The latest tractor and combine sales data from the Association of Equipment Manufacturers shows farmers are interested in large row crop tractors this spring. Michael Clements reports.
Kurt Blades, AEM Senior Vice President of Agriculture, explains the trends from the March sales report.
As we look at the month of March for tractors and combine sales in North America, it was kind of softness across the board, but there was a little bit of a bright spot around tractors that are over 100 horsepower in the United States. Those traditional row crop tractors continue to be strong in March. That's largely due to the fact that we're entering into planting season. We also saw some real softness in combine sales. Combine sales were down about 20% from this time last year. But the other side of that story is this time last year, we had a really strong March. And then we continued to see a little bit of softness in that smaller horsepower tractor market. Those tractors that are under 40 horsepower, they were down 15% for the month of March and approaching 20% for the year. That's really an indication of that market being satisfied.
Blades says the sales reflect the status of the U.S. farm economy.
It's really too soon to tell of what the long-term impact a couple of months into the year does not a year make. But I think there are some indications that the overall farm economy is going to be down a little bit in 2024. I think USDA has some predictions that way. Well, sort of many economists are pointing to that. But the long-term outlook for agriculture continues to be strong. And knowing the amount of technology that's going into those new machines, I'm very optimistic about what the future of farm equipment is going to look like in the next several years, 5 and 10 years out.
After seeing the first quarter's performance, Blade says he'll be keeping a close eye on how commodity prices change going forward.
The biggest thing that's going to be indicating the strength of the ag economy are going to be commodity prices. I mean, there's some ups and downs right now as we look at that market, as certainly as we're entering into this planting season. And then a little bit longer behind that is the passing of a farm bill. It's really important that the farmers feel confident that the economy is going to be able to support their long-term purchases. And that's what that safety net of the farm bill provides. So we're looking forward to that passing, hopefully sometime in 2024.
Outside factors, Blade says, includes demand swings in the global market.
Every year is a little bit different in agriculture, but the one thing that we're really paying attention to is this global market that we're operating in. And there's some interesting things that are happening on the global scale, whether it's changes in commodity flows or if demand that's increased because of biofuels and renewable aviation fluid. It's really going to be an interesting market as we look into 2024 and beyond for farming, specifically here in the Midwest and those farmers that are taking advantage of most of the farm equipment here in the United States.
Learn more online at AEM.org. Michael Clements reporting.
While our nation imports much of its seafood, there is thought that this could lead to opportunities to increase U.S. aquaculture production in order to meet consumer demand. Rod Bain has more.
Seafood consumption in our country has doubled over the past 50 years. Yet David O'Brien of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said at this year's USDA Ag Outlook Forum, when it comes to domestic aquaculture production,
U.S. has really lagged behind much of the rest of the world in terms of aquaculture production. In general, as a nation, we do not meet our substantial untapped potential for being the leader in sustainable aquaculture globally.
In fact, seafood trade reflects a trade deficit for the U.S.
We are one of the largest seafood markets in the world, but we don't produce that much at home. We import at least 70% and up to 85% of our seafood. We're the largest importer of seafood of any country in the world.
Yet O'Brien believes the seafood trade imbalance represents opportunity.
This does represent an untapped potential for us to do more domestically. By doing more seafood domestically, we can recoup some of those opportunities that right now we basically offered and bring them back home domestically and help support our local communities.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Chad Smith reports on breaking the stigma of mental health in farm country.
Studies show that farmer suicide rates are several times higher than the national average. Jessica Cabrera, managing director of member engagement with the American Farm Bureau Federation, says mental health among farmers and ranchers is an important topic.
There are just so many unpredictable experiences in farming. Experiences such as natural disasters, lots of financial uncertainty, fluctuating markets, labor shortages, trade disruptions. There's so many factors that contribute to extreme stress for farmers and ranchers. And they also often live in a very isolated setting, which can compound the issue. I think it's really important to break the stigma around mental health challenges.
If you or someone you know is struggling, the Farm State of Mind website has many resources to help.
You'll find a national resource directory that is searchable. You'll find helpful tips like how to help someone in emotional pain or how to start a conversation with someone. We have videos, including video and radio public service announcements. We have a peer-to-peer support community resource called Togetherall. That resource offers a space for farm family members ages 16 and older, a way to express themselves anonymously and to receive and give peer support.
Cabrera says anyone can be an advocate for mental health in rural America.
I would say the most impactful way to advocate for mental health wellness among farmers and ranchers is to let everyone know it's okay not to be okay. Just reducing that stigma alone, encouraging those who are struggling to reach out for help and to let them know that that is a completely acceptable way to move forward, empowering people to believe that reaching out for help is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness.
For more information, go to fb.org/farmstateofmind. Chad Smith, Washington.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.